This week in the studio, Tom Scholz joins me for the anniversary of Don't Look Back.
The people that run to get into the position of controlling these major labels, these are not like your everyday nice people that are walking down the street. These are people that have, that are smart and ruthless, you know, have clawed their way and destroyed the competition until they got to the top. And you're not talking about a real sweet bunch of guys up there. So it's a tough, tough world. And they have the ability to be, you turn on the charm, and then if there's something they don't like, bang, they just, you know, they throw lightning bolts. A lot of people thought I was really stupid for not just, kissing butt and going along with it, and but I, unfortunately, I can't help it. I'm really rebellious by nature. And as soon as somebody does something to me that I think is wrong, I will not let go. I just keep going with it until it, until I am satisfied with the result, or I have nothing left to fight with. Welcome back in the studio. I'm Tom Scholz with Redbeard.
In August 1978, the stage was being set for a David versus Goliath legal battle that would have a permanent impact on the music world in America. The part of David was about to be portrayed by Tom Scholz, a bright MIT graduate, a mechanical engineer working for the Polaroid Corporation by day, and the mastermind songwriter, guitarist, and keyboard player, and home recording producer of a project that he called Boston. The role of Goliath was the huge CBS Records Company, at that time the biggest U.S. label, and the company that only 2 years earlier had made record-setting profits from Boston's debut. With sales of 9 million albums then, it went on to become the top-selling debut album in history. The issues would later become how and where music could be made, artistic control of the recording, and whether a corporation could refuse to pay royalties owed to the musician, the recording artist. But in August 1978, as Boston's follow-up, Don't Look Back, was being rushed released in blank white cardboard sleeves to rock radio stations, all we knew was that Don't Look Back shared the same humble DNA as the first Boston album. Here's Tom Scholz with me in the studio.
The first Boston album was definitely a little off the wall in that department, because it was made in the basement of my apartment house on strictly a homebrew studio with very little equipment just a lot of a lot of time on my part working with what I had and a fair amount of patience by my upstairs neighbors who could hear every note. It was I'm sure that there are other projects that have been done like that, and you know, you hear stories about Sgt. Pepper being recorded on a four-track someplace, and people doing oddball sort of things. I had to do that out of necessity because I knew that I couldn't get the kind of recordings that I had been making as demos in a fancy production studio with, you know, all these people hanging around and you know, the engineers and assistant engineers and producer types and all that. It just, I absolutely cannot work with somebody looking over my shoulder or listening to every note I'm trying to play or looking at everything I do. I had no choice. I had to do it that way. All of the tracks for the first Boston album, except one, were recorded in this little basement studio on an old 12-track Scully machine, and then mixed eventually at a more standard kind of studio in Los Angeles. I just didn't have enough facilities, you know, down there to mix a record and do a good job, but it was all done there. It took about 6 months.
Oh,
The chorus of that title song, plus the guitar solos in Don't Look Back, always seemed to me to have the soaring majesty of classical music. I was curious if Tom Scholz had been exposed to classical composers.
I did listen to a few of them. Basically, I was about three, and my parents had this monster speaker, so they just like plant me in front of it with this bunch of albums, and I figured out where to push the buttons. So I'd entertain myself for hours. I think it was so, you know, so they get away without having a babysitter, and I wouldn't know when they took off. It did kind of sink in, and I remember a lot of that real heavy classical music. Ones I like would be, let's see, Rachmaninoff. He was the heaviest dude. He had great hair too. Rachmaninoff, Beethoven. You know, he was a little too sticky sweet, but he was still good. And Rachmaninoff wrote something called the Prelude in G sharp minor, which is a real, real heavy piece. And it has this thing at the end with a pipe organ. It's got awesome power. So if you check that out, I'm sure you've all got a copy of Rachmaninoff's Prelude in G sharp minor at home. Dig that out of your library. Check out the end of that song, and then listen to The End of Long Time or the start of I Need Your Love. And you'll hear that influence there with that pipe organ at the front.
Growing up in Toledo, Ohio, on Top 40 Radio in its glory days, Tom Scholz heard guitar players who are still revered as the best.
My early influences for guitar, I'd have to say Jeff Beck, Joe Walsh from the James Gang days, Eric Clapton from Yardbirds and Cream, and my older brother who would never let me touch his Fender Strat when I was in high school. Beck was by far and away the most, the best guitar player at just about everything. Best feel, funkiest, most melodic, and I think he still is today. Let's see, I'm not really sure that my keyboard training influenced my approach to guitar or anything except I think it made me allergic to pianos for a while. I guess my keyboard training made me realize when I first started guitar that it would be a really bad idea for me to take lessons since it didn't work with piano, so I didn't. I taught myself how to play that too, which is explains why I play that the way I do.
Tom Scholz used much of the profits from the initial Boston album sales and touring to construct an improved home studio that he called The Hideaway.
I had a lot of trouble with that particular studio. It was, it was another basement studio. And I swore I'd never build another studio underground as long as I lived after that one. I had floods in the basement. Not floods like the Mississippi going over the banks, but the kind where it rains too hard and something goes wrong and water starts pouring in through the cracks. Had that happen several times. Had constant problems with just losing the power to the place when there were storms. And it's funny now. It wasn't at the time. I did an awful lot of work in that studio on wet carpet.
I got no time.
Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Tom Scholz for the anniversary of Boston's Don't Look Back.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Tom Scholz with Redbeard.
Thank you, Tom. Neil Young once told me that his philosophy of recording rock and roll is like, and I quote, taking a snapshot rather than laboriously painting a picture. Tom Scholz of Boston, then, may be the ultimate sound painter.
Well, you know, the thing about snapshots is, you know how many of them you get back and you look at and they really look lousy? I mean, they don't even look anything like what you took the picture of. Well, that's sort of the way I look at snapshots of a performance. Maybe you'll get lucky and it'll look a lot better than it really was, but it's kind of hard to take snapshots anyway when you have to play more than one instrument overdubbing on a track. So, well, unless you're good at double exposures, I guess. Yes, actually, I do an awful lot of overdubbing and running the tape back and forth, and I have come to some really unique solutions that I think work well. I use two separate 2-inch masters for one for the instruments and one for the vocals, and I also got this really good brand of sex lubricant that I put on the heads every day, and I haven't worn out of tape since I started doing that. Don't try that at home, by the way.
I'm getting ready for a party tonight. Yes, I'm getting ready to cruise. And if you got something for me, I
fun little rave up on Don't Look Back. That's Boston with the song called Party. Tom Scholz wrote Boston songs, played guitar and keyboards, even engineered the recordings, which all adds up to being the producer. Tom Scholz shares with us a list of his favorite rock producers.
Well, let's see. I like Todd Rundgren. I like Mutt Lange, Def Leppard's producer. I like Bill Simzik. He did James Gang Rides Again way back when. Great sounding record. Actually, nobody influenced me to produce my own record. It was just that was the only way I was going to get one, so I kind of had to do it. And really, I figured then I would rather screw it up myself than have somebody else do it. The technical side of making a record is just a necessary evil that you have to put up with in the course of trying to get your music on the tape. It's a pain, it takes a long time, it's tedious, but it makes me really look forward to those rare moments when I actually get to pick up a guitar and play it. And I'd say the most important technical thing of making a Boston record is that I basically break all the rules. All the tracks are recorded way too hot. I mean, if I'm not bending the needles on the meter bridge, then it's not loud enough. And the singer stands right next to the 24-track deck, and I make sure that my guitar is making lots of extra background noise. Basically, you break all the rules, and you come up with something that sounds different than everybody else.
When Tom Scholz recorded the first Boston album in his basement, necessity may have been the mother of invention, but poverty made it so. Like Mike Oldfield's legendary Tubular Bells album in the early 70s, Tom Scholz needed more discrete tracks than his limited equipment would allow, so Scholz had to ping-pong the recording back and forth between two master tapes.
And also Don't Look Back. I also recorded that one the same way. I would go on to one master, one multi-track master for the basics, drums, bass, and a couple of guitar tracks, and then I would transfer to a brand new tape on another 24-track machine to do the vocals and lead guitars and so forth. I never wore a hole through the tape to the back. I think I'd get really worried if I saw that. I had the problem early on, back long before there was a record released. I had that same problem working on a 12-track machine where I wore the oxide off the tape, and as I was listening, I kept thinking, well, this is sounding worse and worse. And the thing is, that happens subjectively when you listen for too long to something. It starts to sound worse and worse. But this really was getting worse and worse. With every single pass, more oxide was being worn off. And, it collects in little piles of dust at the base of the heads and around the rollers. So it was a pretty disheartening experience.
MIT graduate mechanical engineer Tom Scholz even tried a high-tech robotic synchronizer to strap the two 24-track recorders together.
Yeah, well, the original one was the store-bought method. It was the state-of-the-art synchronizer with this enormous amount of wiring and preparation and several technician types doing the installation. To sync up these two tape decks so that I could get 48 tracks. This is back before people did that. Today they do that all the time, but not back then. And the thing was such a pain in the neck, and it really worked so badly that I tore the whole thing out, and I put on a set of headphones, and I put one track from one machine in one ear and the same track recorded on the other machine in the other ear, and started the two tape decks, and I grabbed one reel on one tape deck to slow it down if it was getting too far ahead, and and stuck my thumb on the reel of the other one if that one was going too fast. And I got really good at getting these two machines to run exactly together. I mean, completely in sync, by being the human synchronizer. I felt a little stupid doing it, but it worked.
If I said what's on my mind, you'd turn and walk away, disappearing way back in your dreams.
Oh,
The next time you hear that song, A Man I'll Never Be, from Boston's second album, Don't Look Back, just imagine that instrumental bridge and solo played by violins and cellos in an orchestra. Next up in the studio, corporate power players and greed invade the idealistic world of Tom Scholz's rock and roll band. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Tom Scholz for the anniversary of Boston's Don't Look Back.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Tom Scholz with Redbeard.
After Boston's first album became the top-selling debut in history, eventually selling 17 million copies, Tom Scholz planned to take his time crafting a follow-up, of course. This would not be the case, however, for by the midsummer of 1978, CBS Records needed a blockbuster in the fourth quarter to prop up their annual balance sheet, and the record company demanded that Tom Scholz release the second Boston album. When Scholz replied that it wasn't done, CBS Records literally took the master tapes from Scholz's basement studio. In hindsight, Tom has another hunch on why the record company execs rushed him to release Don't Look Back.
You know, the funny thing is, I got the feeling afterwards that CBS had no confidence in a second Boston album, that they were just looking at it as cashing in the rest of the way on a band that had a good first album. And I have kind of always thought that they never expected it to sell 6 million copies. That was when I realized that how naive I was about the business. You know, I realized the record company did not care about the quality or anything like that, or getting the most out of what I could do. I at that point I felt that nobody did, not the manager, not the record company, and it was basically just me sort of against the world as far as trying to maintain my values in. In pursuing music. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that don't have any values pursuing music, that just really want to be successful. And I don't have anything against them, but that's not me. I never really cared that much if I was a mega success or not, or a millionaire. I didn't get into it for that reason. I did want to make enough money to be able to pursue it as a lifetime career. But I just didn't care about the rest of that. And I realized that I was alone. I think that was the worst part of it.
Rockin'
Regardless of the record company's misgivings, the Don't Look Back album sold 7 million copies.
You know, Don't Look Back did very well. I haven't heard a lot of people complain about the fact that, you know, the second side only had 4 songs on it and it was very short. It had a couple of songs that I really like, and I'm glad it's out there. I think if it had not been done under such enormous pressure, and I won't go into that, but there was more of this, you know, sort of tricks and so forth pulled that made it really impossible for me to finish that thing.
The legal tricks would eventually spawn rancorous lawsuits that would drag on for 6 years. It was a modern-day David versus Goliath legal battle. Yes, other musicians had recorded and produced their own albums before, that's true, but none had succeeded in making this staggering profit like Tom Scholz in Boston. But even beyond the corporate greed, the battleground became artistic control, and it got personal.
Usually, from what I have seen, in my case and with other people, it's usually not that there is a real serious intrinsic problem. It's usually personalities. The people that run to get into the position of controlling these major labels, these are not like your everyday nice people that are walking down the street. These are people that are smart and ruthless, you know, have clawed their way and destroyed the competition until they got to the top. And you're not talking about a real sweet bunch of guys up there. So it's a tough, tough world. And they have the ability to be, you turn on the charm, and then if there's something they don't like, bang, they just, they throw a lightning bolt. So a lot of people thought I was really stupid for not just, kissing butt and going along with it, and but I unfortunately can't help it. I'm really rebellious by nature, and as soon as somebody does something to me that I think is wrong, I will not let go. I just keep going with it until it until I am satisfied with the result, or I have nothing left to fight with.
we'd like to dedicate this anniversary look at Boston's Don't Look Back to the late Brad Delp, who sang every note of those first three Boston albums, including this one, Don't Look Back. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest, Tom Scholz. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet, theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.